You're listening to 515, the Ultraman podcast, the show that invites you into the lives of people who make up the Ultra family. Here's your host for these conversations, Larry Ryan.
Thanks, MJ. Welcome all to today's episode. My conversations today are with two athletes who are focusing their attention around the sport they love. One with a few years and a lot of races under his belt, Arno Sulikov, and the other, closer to the beginning of the journey, Caroline Bloom. Today, I'm going to start the podcast with some Ultraman breaking news. You may have noticed that I don't make this show about me. Even in the first episode, I went directly into my first conversation with Steve King. But today, I have to insert myself into the podcast. I have stepped away from Ultraman Canada, and Brad Sawa is now the sole race director going forward. The good news is everything is great with me. I am not leaving due to any devastating issues in my life. The other good news is that I intend to continue to do this podcast. It will not feature Ultraman Canada athletes in profile going forward, after the next episode, which I already have recorded, but the interesting people and stories will continue in a new format. If you listen to Season 1, Episode 10, when I had Brad on, you will know some of the story about how I came to help him out with organizing his first Ultraman race in 2019. You will have to listen to the full episode to get the full story, but here is a little bit about how Brad was the one who ended up getting the Ultraman branded race. At the time, the Ohana around the race thought there was going to be a hole in the Ultra community, as Steve Brown said that he was ending the Ultra 520.
And so that morning, over breakfast, I was talking to Sigurd, my wife, about it. And I said, Sigurd, what could we do? Is there anything we can do like to try and keep a race going? So we were having the conversation where, yeah, like, let's, you know, what do we do? Do we start a new race and do we call it Ultra Canada or do we call or, you know, and so we didn't really know. I mean, that's not being race directors and owning a race. It wasn't an ambition of ours. Like we were really, you know, just a young couple looking at starting a family. We already had, I had my fingers in a couple different businesses at the time. I was looking for more free time, not, you know, I wasn't looking to take more on. I was looking to take less on was sort of what the position I was in at that time. So yeah, my phone rang while I was talking to Sigurd about, you know, let's keep this race going. And it was Michael Brown, who I raced with at Ultraman Canada in 2012.
And so with Michael Brown's vast knowledge of putting on events and triathlons, they decided to team up and bring the Ultraman brand back to Canada.
You know, he had his fingers in a lot of things. He had the contract for Challenge Penticton, I think for 3 out of the 5 years that it operated in Penticton. And so Michael was already set up with a lot of the equipment, the logistics, the connections to make this happen. And so he called me up. I was actually a little bit surprised because I didn't know maybe what he needed Brad for.
So with Michael Brown's past experience in Penticton, the two of them teamed up and were ready to take on Ultraman Canada. Unfortunately, the races in Penticton weren't working out as Michael Brown had wanted, and this caused a few problems with the Ultraman.
There was a whole can of worms that I had nothing to do with. But it created hard feelings for my partner and Penticton. So unfortunately, that really took a lot of the wind out of the sails for my partner coming to the, you know, and being part of this event. So he was really a lot of the brains of all of this. You know, I was sort of, I don't know, I was kind of a cheerleader up until that point. You know, I was doing a lot of social media stuff like, you know, just, hey, come out and do this race, you know, and he was, you know, pulling permits and organizing, you know, to make sure that we had a finish line and generators and medals and finisher shirts, you know, that was kind of the roles. And so he still offered support, But I, all of a sudden, I ended up more in the driver's seat as opposed to the passenger seat. And I wasn't prepared for that. I didn't know that I was going to be taking on as much as I was. There was a lot of surprises.
It was at this time that I was traveling on a summer vacation and I was passing through Penticton, and I actually stopped and stayed with Brad for a night, and we were talking about the race and what was happening. And it was clear to me that he wasn't feeling very comfortable with being able to put on this race by himself. Now, having been at the race for 10 years through Ultraman Canada and Ultra 520, and pretty confident in my organizational skills, after I went back home, I called him up and said, you know what, I'd be happy to help you out. I can come in and give you some of the details that you might need and help you to organize some of this stuff.
You could probably see the fear in my eyes. I think it was just the realization was setting in that, like, I have no idea what's going on here. I'm in over my head. I really felt it. And so I think you spent the night at my place that night, and we hung out and drank a few beers. And then did you leave? You went back to Vancouver the next day? Yeah. And then I think you called me up like a week later or something. And Larry just said, hey man, do you need some help? And I didn't shy away from saying, yes, I need help. And thank goodness I did.
So I showed up about a week out from the race, and we threw that entire thing together. As it was an amazing experience to try and put together an entire Ultraman in just that amount of time.
Larry's vision for logistics, for knowing how to get athletes around the course safely and, you know, in a good way, his vision for making a finish line out of nothing, and, you know, for elevating the event way beyond what it would have been without him there. I was disappointed with how things were turning out, but Larry came and elevated it to a place where I could be proud of, where I could walk away from it feeling good about it.
Despite this stressful experience for Brad, he was still interested in asking for a longer contract with Ultraman, and I had had a lot of fun pulling this together, so we decided to go ahead as co-race directors. I share this story with you again as a way of bringing the event full circle for me, or in case you didn't know my involvement previously. I don't leave with any sadness toward having to separate from the event now. In fact, I'm quite happy with all that I've learned. Not having the knowledge of how certain things worked did not stop me from going out and learning on the job, and I've always enjoyed learning new things. You know, I figured out how to take the payments online with Square and do the merch. I updated the website with the help of James at Young Media. And within that, I embedded the application form and then reviewed every application that came in and then corresponded with the athletes each step of the way. These were great times. I got to know a lot of people. I was able to design and commission all of the infrastructure like tents and flags and whatnot, and most of the swag for the race, including our handmade trophies this year, which were a big hit. The thing I am most proud of is the finish line that we used this year. That has the entire history of Ultraman Canada on it. It took a long time for me to design and to work out, but I believe it turned out to be just amazing. I hope that Brad continues on adding to that great legacy piece. I also had a lot of fun promoting the race, doing the Facebook posts, and of course, this podcast. So while I'm leaving the race, I feel that I've learned a whole lot from my experience. And for that, I am most grateful. Meeting great people, learning new things, what more could a guy ask for? So even without an association to the race, moving forward, I intend to keep this podcast going and share those conversations that I know you all enjoy. I have had other 515 races come onto the podcast, like Ultra MX in episode 6 of season 1, and most recently, Ultra Check last episode. So I hope to bring you more of the same rather than have the UMC focus going forward. Hopefully I transition to doing athlete profiles for other races out there. So race directors, drop me a line and let's talk. Well, that's the breaking news. I feel like I'm leaving on a high note after a successful race this year. Knowing that the next year is already sold out and the following year is half sold, I think that says quite a lot. Good luck, Brad, with those races and the rest of your contract as you go forward. Okay, let's get into the second to last Ultraman Canada profile, since I already had these recorded. Here's my conversation with former Ultraman Florida finisher, Caroline Lee. Today's athlete in profile is joining me from Colorado Springs, Colorado. She is an Ohana member, having raced at the Ultraman Florida in 2020, where she placed second in the women's division. Recently, she won the 24 Hours in the Canyon race. She's a woman who says she is married to triathlon. Today's guest is Caroline Bloom. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So if you're married to triathlon, are you ready for a divorce at this point? Because you can't be getting much back from it these days.
No, I'm pretty committed to it at this point. I think I'm in it for the long haul. You know, I guess it is kind of like a marriage. All my money goes to it too. So what are you going to do?
Yeah. So Colorado, that's a bit of a hub for triathlon. Lots of people want to go and train at altitude and things like that. Do you ever get a chance to go to any of the camps there? And have you had a chance to work with any of the big names in triathlon or see them at camps?
Yes and no. When I moved here, actually the day I moved here, I got robbed. So like the moving truck got robbed 2 hours after we pulled into the house. So I didn't like Colorado for a while. I spent my first couple months just kind of hating it here, and it was winter, and I'm from Florida. So I just kind of hid in the house for a while. Started getting used to it. And then it was basically Ultraman training time. So I just put my head into the training and didn't think about anything else at all. And then after Ultraman, COVID hit. So I feel like last summer I started doing outside things like seeing mountains and hiking and finally learning about Colorado. But with COVID and the timing of my race and when I moved here, I feel like I haven't got to do a lot of the things that you would expect. But at the same time, I ended up with a job at Pikes Peak Athletics as an assistant triathlon coach with Justin Trolley, who is one of the big USAT educators. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of fallen in with some, you know, by luck, a little bit of USA Triathlon and things like that, but not as much as I should probably.
Got to take advantage of those connections.
Yeah.
So what brought you over to Colorado then from Florida?
Well, I moved to Austin first. My folks were about an hour north of Austin. 2013 was kind of a crummy year. I think it was 8 funerals in 7 months. And I just thought, I want to live near my mom. And so I moved out to Texas. And then after a year or two there, my mom was like, I hate it here. I want to move back to Florida. And I was like, well, I'm here now. You can't leave. Like you're stuck. But I met someone who was transferred here in the Army, came with him out here. And then as soon as I did, my mom moved back to Florida. And then we broke up, but I'm still here and I don't regret it. It's a great place to be. A lot of great things here in Colorado Springs. So pretty grateful to be here.
Well, that's a good story of getting there and sticking it out even after the fact of the relationship. Mm-hmm. Because you have your other relationship anyway, so that'll hold you over.
I think he knew triathlon came first anyway, so can't.
Yeah. In the intro, I mentioned that you won the 24 Hours in the Canyon, and I saw on your resume that you've done that race a number of times. Can you just tell us exactly what that race entails and what is it that keeps you going back?
Well, I went the first time as just a helper. We actually rode in. It was someone, actually the same person who introduced me to Ultraman. We rode in to 24 Hours in the Canyon on a motorcycle with a bicycle attached to the back of the motorcycle. He takes off on the bike and then everyone disappears. And I'm just looking around like, what do I what's happening? And this lady comes up to me and she goes, what are you doing? I'm like, well, he took off on the bike and everyone's gone and I don't know where to go. And she said, well, this isn't where you sleep. That's, 8 miles down the road. And they ended up taking me in. And she was one of the event, really involved in the event and the foundation that the event supports. And Haley Bell and her mom, they just took me in and I camped out with them. And the next year I thought, I want to come do this. And so I had a pathetic attempt. I slept all night. I rode 100 miles, slept all night, rode a couple miles, slept for a couple hours. And then when I started with my coach, I was like, I want to do this. I want to actually race for 24 hours. So I came back and just the goal was stay on the bike. So that was, the goal. The next year we got flooded. So the race was canceled. Then 2020 happened. So it was my first chance, but the people are why I go back. I get that way. Same with Ultraman Florida. Mm-hmm. You meet the people, you find out what the event's about and you fall in love with it. And I want to go back next year to help my friends who helped me. They want to ride, and then I want to go back and the goal would be to do 400 miles in the 24 hours. So yeah, I'm just in love with the event. You ride out of the Palo Duro Canyon. You do a 100-mile loop. You ride back down into the Palo Duro Canyon, and then you do a 5-mile loop for the rest of the 24 hours. Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
And how far did you get on the last race?
310 miles. I feel pretty good. I was actually signed up for the Double Anvil in Oregon, and it got canceled. That was my birthday present, April 25th. I found out it got canceled. So we thought, well, we've been putting in, I was bummed to miss the Canyon race anyway. It was the week before the race would have been. And I talked to coach and I was like, the Canyon, let's go. Like I've been practicing slow, steady miles. I've been practicing nutrition over extended periods of time. Like, let's do it. So we didn't have a super amount of training specific for a 24-hour race. Right. I've been doing speed walking and hiking and swimming and all these things. So we kind of went with the fitness I had and I was pretty excited about it.
That's great. And when you won that event, do you automatically want to go back and be like, oh, not only do I need to get that 400, but I need to defend my title?
A little bit. It was the most anticlimactic win. The way it works is you, it's noon to noon and you ride until you stop. Right. And I kept thinking, what if I finish at 23 hours and, 42 minutes? Do I try to do one more lap? Because it only goes till you cross the timing belt. So I could have done another mile and it doesn't matter. It's only the last time you cross before the 24 hours. And I ended up crossing, it was like 23 hours and 48 minutes. So there was no way to do another loop. And I just was just feeling kind of bleh. And I crossed through the finish line and no one does anything. There's no clapping. There's no cheering. I went through and then I was like, oh, and then I just went and sat down at the pit crew area. And I just cried for a little while. And I was like, I guess I won. Like, I don't know.
Is there a way of knowing when you're doing laps? Are you aware of how many laps you've done versus other people? And
At 4 something in the morning, they started posting the numbers. So my crew was able to give me a little bit of info after a while, but then I thought they made up that someone was trying to beat me to keep me going because they said, oh, someone's like the same number of loops, but like 1 minute ahead of you. And I was like, oh no, not anymore. And so I like worked kind of hard to get a lead. And then I asked and they're like, oh, I don't know. Just keep going. And I was like, well, is someone coming up on me or not? Like, tell me. And like, I'd come around, I'm like, what about the other person? And they're like, just keep riding. And I was like, is this fake? Are they real? Did they stop riding? Are they like right behind me? So that was an interesting aspect. Later, I was like, did you make up that person? Cause I never saw that number that you said. And she's like, no, they were there. She must've just been like exactly on the opposite side of the loop from me the whole time or something.
That's an interesting race.
Yeah.
And you've also, as you said, you've done Florida. You have a little bit of a problem with the mascot for Florida.
Oh, it literally took me 3 years to do the race because of alligators. Like, I crewed that race three times before I did it in 17, 18, and 19. And I was the paddler each time.
Oh, yeah.
Simply because I had to be in the water to make sure that there weren't alligators. Like, I had to make sure I didn't see one. Because I grew up in Florida. I'm no fool. I know that every body of water in Florida has an alligator. Like, yeah. These are things I know. I grew up knowing this. So the first 2 years were in Lake Conway, but right. And then, but the year before I raced, they moved lakes. And then mm-hmm. I was like, oh, here we go. Like, now I've gotten comfortable with this other lake. And now I have to, you know, prepare myself for a different lake. And the water's red. So when I crewed, you know, for this athlete, Pra from India, and the water's red, and I could see the bottoms of his feet and the tops of his hand were like pink as he's swimming. And I was like, oh, this is, oh my. So I was glad to see that water before I had to get in it. But I made a bet with my deal with my coach. And I was like, if you get me out of the water in under 3.5 hours, I will give you beer for a year. And I did. And if you watch, I mean, I've posted it, but there's video of my Ultraman Florida speech, and I'm a musician. I have all my instruments are right where you can't see, but I do a thing called Ukevember every November on my ukulele. And it's just a thing I do. And so my speech was a song, and I made Jeremy stand up, and I gave him $570 something in ones, which is how much it would be to have a 12 pack to buy beer for a year in 12 packs.
Right.
And so that was what I get me out of the water, beer for a year. And we did it. So.
and why is the water red?
I think it has to do with like mangroves and the plants that are in the water. Yeah. It's pretty creepy. But I looked into the water in Canada, and there is like a Loch Ness monster in the lake that we have to swim in. And
Ogopogo.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. I posted my, like, hey, I'm officially doing Canada. I posted the link and no one is worried about me. Like, I'm worried about me and no one's worried about me. Everyone's like, ah, you swim with gators. I'm like, yeah, this seems more serious. Like,
yeah. Well, it's what? A really big lake. So Ogopogo could be way down the other end.
Yeah. But yeah. You better be
100 kilometers away.
I think Jeremy would laugh and not save me. My paddler, my coach will be paddling with me again.
Well, that's excellent. So yeah. When you did finally get around to racing Florida, by now you know so many of the people because you've been crewing and you've mm-hmm. met a lot of the racers and a lot of the crew and things like that. And you ended up coming in second in the women's division, which is great. And who did you come second place to? Is that someone that you're aware of?
Didi Griesbauer,
yeah.
Who I didn't know of at the time. Mainly because I'm new to triathlon and I seem to have been in a cave. Like people talk about famous triathletes and I'm like, well, I know Rennie. Like, I just didn't know a lot of names and I'm mm-hmm. slowly learning all of the people I should know about right. this whole time. So I didn't exactly know who she was until I'd say a couple months before. My coach was like, oh, there's this pro who's coming and, you know, here are the expectations, you know, because we thought there was this whole thing like, when I started with my coach, it was, can you finish? Like, can we get you in the time allotment? And then it became like, you could place, you could win. Like, we don't know who's going to be there, you know? And it was kind of like the far away dream that you don't want to say out loud. Like, maybe I could win. Mm-hmm. But Dee Dee was amazing. I mean, my speech also, you know, my slightly intoxicated self also was like, Dee Dee, can I come to Boulder and just like by osmosis, like get all of your greatness? And she just laughed and we're still in touch. I mean, she's helping me still to this day with stuff, putting me in touch with Jordan and trying to help me get all the things I need for Ultraman Canada. Yeah. And I love listening to her announce Ironman stuff. And like, I know her, she beat me by hours and she's amazing. So that was pretty cool. The other fun fact about Dee Dee is my coach pulled up my best, I think it was my best mile in the whole bike ride. Mm-hmm. He said, your best mile in the whole bike ride was right here. And I look at the map and I go, oh, that's when I saw Dee Dee. And he just like, what? And the way it's kind of a lollipop, you kind of go up and then in a little bubble and then come back down. And I hadn't seen another person at all. I had seen zero people. I came out of the water. I was told I was second and I thought they were lying. And then I ride my bike and I'm all by myself. And I see Dee Dee come at me and I just went, Dee Dee. And she was like, you got it. Dee Dee says, I got this. And that was my best mile of the whole race.
Yeah. That's the great thing about the camaraderie of the whole event, where you have those people that are out there cheering you on while they're in the middle of a race.
Yeah, yeah. It was great.
I understand that it wasn't your best physical self that showed up at that race. What was going on with your body when you were at Ultraman Florida that might have affected, you know, you probably would have been like right with Dee Dee otherwise.
But. Oh yeah. I mean, like right on our heels.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's the, what we thought at the time and what we know now. I've been working with a personal trainer. We figured out once I got dual-sided power that my imbalance was my legs were like 70, 30 and 60, 40 with power. So part of it would, could have been just imbalances and it just popped up during the race. Part of it was I went into the race with saddle sores and was sitting crooked on the bike, we think. Mm-hmm. So I finished day one and was like, oh, my knee doesn't feel so good. I don't feel so great. Day two, 5 miles in, I had an ice pick in my kneecap. So it just wasn't going to get better. By mile 130, I was physically screaming out loud on the bike. To myself, you can do this. This is why you train. Keep going. Like they're right behind you. Like anything I could say, my coach, Jeremy.
Not Howard, curse words. I would have thought
not curse words. He actually had me write it all down. So I actually have gone back and read all of the nice things I yelled at myself to the point that I couldn't talk after day two. Cause it took everything I had to stay on the bike. And then day three, half a mile in, I started limping. So there was just no, I wasn't going to stop. We didn't think I was injured in the way that I was going to never race again if I kept going. Right. We just knew something was aggravated. My physical therapist came with me. So she was there and we just figured something was aggravated. And I don't know, being crooked or if now we think maybe some of the imbalances popped up that never had shown before, maybe both combined. There was no way I was stopping and that was the end of it. I was going to go no matter what. What was tricky is that, you know, you kind of run out of mental juice, you know, like day three, everyone kind of, your brain's tired. You've been racing all this time and the worse your body feels, the more your brain, you have to convince yourself, right? It's so mental. Yeah. That started for me on the beginning of day two. So my brain was pretty tired going into day three. And I finally broke down at mile 47 of the run. I remember looking, I couldn't put together sentences. I was just yesing and knowing and nodding. And at mile 47 around there, I remember seeing a pond and asking Jeremy if he would just push me in so the alligators would get me. I was like, do you think there's gators in there? Can you just push me in? That was the point about, and then I had to tell him my crew was amazing. And around mile 50, I had to tell Jeremy to make them go away. Cause they were like, you got it. And I was like, I know. Stop yelling at me. Stop telling me I can do it. I know I can do it. Go away. Like I was like, Jeremy, make them leave. Like, I don't want to see them, which is unlike me as a human. Like I'm usually the person cheering, you got this, go. And they were in costumes and they were being so fun and I was over it. I just knew I could do it. There was no question that I could do it. Right. I just didn't want to hear about it. And then I felt really guilty about that. I had like very little brain capacity, but I felt bad about it. And at the last mile, you know, everyone can join you and your whole crew can run. And they all came in and my friends that were like house crew and everyone's there. And they're like, they start running ahead of me. And I was trying to be funny. And I was like, hey guys, do you mind if maybe I'm in the front? And then everyone got like really quiet. I was like, it was a joke. And like, I'm sorry. I don't know how to laugh. Like, I don't know how to be funny right now. I'm too out of it. And I think I told them to shut up also. And yeah, I was in a pretty dark, ugly, gross place. But I think my last mile was one of my fastest miles of the whole race. So, and then I couldn't walk, and then I went into shock, and then it was pretty bad. So yeah, it's great.
But I think people need to hear about these stories, that not everybody's going to cross the finish line feeling great, and that even in day one, you can get into trouble, and sometimes you can push through to day two and day three as well. And obviously you had some serious conditions there on day two with the ice pick in your knee, and the fact that you're able to show that you have that mental fortitude to get through that day two and then day three, and recognize that at some point you needed to have your crew go away because they were just too cheerleady. I think telling these stories is important for people to hear, because everybody's going to handle things differently, and there are different ways to handle it. And at the time, it might not be the best way, but it's the way that's going to get you through. And I don't think you had anything to apologize for that.
Luckily, that's, you know, my coach knew. I mean, he knew, and yeah, he got it. Jamie Harris and her wife crewed for me. Well, Jamie has been there. Mm-hmm. Her wife has seen her be there. So, you know, and Bob too, just kind of went with the flow. So I don't, I have still apologized to everybody, but I think they all just understood. I think, you know, at the finish line, my family was there, my friends, cause I lived in Orlando. So everyone, you know, wanted to come, and I think they were a little in shock to see how poorly I was at the end. But I really tried to put on a smile, you know, it took me a little while, but yeah, it wasn't all smiles and rainbows, but even that way, it was still my favorite weekend ever of my life, even with the pain and even being my grumpy self and the way I was, like, I wouldn't change it. And two of the people that came, my house crew from Ultraman Florida, came to the canyon with me as crew. And I said, just remember, like, I may not be pretty at all times. Like, I may, and I didn't get to the same place, but I was like, just remember anything I say. I don't mean it. Like, I love you. Thank you for being here. And I'm sorry if I'm snippy. Like, I don't mean it. So.
Yeah. Well, you're really lucky now to have that crew around you that's had that experience with you, and they know you, and you know them, and we need to get to know you still a little bit better. So we're going to go into our 2 minutes in transition to start firing off some more quick fire questions and hit the personal stuff on the other side. Are you ready?
Okay.
What else is on your radar or on that bucket list of things that you just feel like you need to do racing wise?
But 400 miles in 24 hours is pretty high up on that list. Past that, I don't actually know.
What was your childhood sport?
Oh, I was the kid who got notes out of PE class. I walked the mile in 19 minutes for the physical. And as a musician, I didn't want to hurt my hands playing anything. So I got notes out. I did some soccer and basketball in middle school, but I was not athletic at all, at all.
I'm a PE teacher. I know that kid.
Yeah, that was me.
What do you do for fun that doesn't involve swim, bike, and run?
I really like to garden, and I like to sew, and I like to cook. I'm basically a grandma.
What is your go-to workout music?
I don't listen to music. When at Ultraman in 2017, I saw my athlete who trained with music not able to race with music, and that was really hard for them, so I cut music out in 2017.
And have you had a chance to race anything since COVID has started?
Yeah, I did 2 little Olympics, one this past Saturday, and then Jeremy, coach, came to town in July, and we did a race together then. Those were my first races. I guess I did the Canyon, first triathlons since Ultraman Florida, since COVID started. And it was also the first time in a long time that I put all 3 sports in one day back together. So that was kind of fun too.
One of the things that you mentioned in your pre-interview with me is that some people seek substances in order to get through things, but you seek out training. Tell me a little bit about how that helps you to get through in your daily life. And you also mentioned that you've had some post-race depression before as well. And I think that's very common for anybody who has that big race that they've been working up to and then the letdown afterwards. So how do you balance that training of yours? You say you're married to try, so obviously this is something that's a very big part of your life. How does that all fit into your mental health?
After Ultraman, I was injured. And my way of dealing with things now is for sure training through it. And training it away, if you will, which is hard too, because when I have big life events that happen, my coach tends to dial my training down for stress reasons. And, and you know, the stress of dealing with trauma can be as much as doing a 100-mile bike ride, you know, like your body can still be stressed. But after Ultraman, I couldn't do anything. I was doing like 15-minute walks around the block, you know, and had knee pain, and I'd hurt my shoulder before the race, so I couldn't swim and I couldn't do anything. And then COVID hit. So then I'm just stuck in my house, can't train, can't do anything. And Jess Zace, who also was at Ultraman Florida, and Jeremy and I had a group chat. And I think poor Jeremy, Jess was going through it too. And we texted all day. I think we must have literally talked every 4 minutes for like a couple weeks because we both were just, we didn't know what to do. Like, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. I didn't know what to do. It was just everything at once, being hurt, not being able to do what I want to do, not being able to go. I thought, oh, after the race, I can go rock climbing. I can go out and do all these things, you know, and learn Colorado. And I was like, oh no, I can't, leave my house. So yeah, it wasn't the best of situations.
Yeah. And I think a lot of athletes were going through that as well. Obviously yours was compounded by the injury. But I think a lot of people were really finding that hard, and it's great that you were able to reach out and have those friends that are able to help you out with that. And I would think that if there's still people out there that are dealing with those sorts of issues, that hopefully they have that connection as well and that support group that they can reach out to. Just jumping back for a second, you know, you were talking about that you were a music teacher and, but you actually gave that up, as kind of your pursuit of triathlon, right? Like it was getting in the way.
Well, the kids knew my heart wasn't there. Yeah. They 100% knew. You get like 9 days a year for sick and personal leave. I was gone like 12, 15 days a year, always to race or to do this event or that thing. I would be gone. I'd come back the next day and the kids would always say, where's your medal? Let me read your shirt. Like they knew. It got to the point that when I put my notice in, my boss is like, yeah, I knew this was coming. And they had me do career day as a athlete. Cause they were like, well, you might as well come do career day as an athlete. Cause we need some people. And that's kind of what you are now. So, yeah.
And you also took on some other triathlon related work as well.
Yeah, I really have interest in coaching. I think it's, you know, my coach is my role model. I just appreciate so much the attention that he's given me and helped me become who I am, you know, inside triathlon and out. Like he's just like my therapist and my coach and my friend. And in through that, I've asked a lot of questions. Well, why this? Why this? How come? And then it just, you know, people were sort of coming to me saying, oh, I saw you did this. Can you help me? And then it turned into, I think I want to get my coaching certification. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of did that and then coached a few people, a few friends. And I traded dog sitting, house sitting for coaching for a while. And then, yeah, this Justin Trelet comes into the bike shop. I'm like, hey, I recognize you from my USAT Zoom course. And he was like, yeah, do you want a job? So then now I get to, you know, kind of work there and see a team of triathletes in action and learn that way too, which has been really cool.
You were working in the bike shop. Is that right?
Yeah. So I work at Criterium Bikes here in Colorado Springs, which is great. I walked in, I really wanted to learn mechanic-y things. I now know the volume of service that shop does, and the owner should have just laughed at me. Like he should have literally, when I was like, I want to learn about be a mechanic, he should have been like, okay, crazy town. But Nick Ponser actually wants to do Ultraman Canada. It's on his bucket list. So when we started talking about Ultraman, he knew what it was. And I was like, whoa, awesome. Problem is, it's a summer race. And as the owner of a bike shop, with the busy season being summer, the difficult one for him to make it to. But they put me in as cashier, and then I've slowly worked my way into bigger responsibilities. But cycling was, I'd say, my weakest of the three sports for a long time. And I just wanted to get better at bikes. Any way I could get better at bikes, learning about them, being around them, being with people who like them, giving me opportunities to ride with people who are good at bikes, all of that. So that's what I did.
Yeah, you definitely jumped fully into the triathlon world.
Yeah, it's my favorite. Yeah.
So how many bikes do you own?
Well, it's tricky because I just bought a new bike, but I sold my race bike, but I have them both at the same time right now. One, two, three, four, I guess five right now, technically. The first triathlon bike I ever bought, the guy actually bought it back from me a couple months ago. He was like, "Hey, do you still have my bike?" I was like, "Yeah, I don't, it's sitting in the corner." He's like, "Can I have it back?" So I sold that back to him. So I kind of like rented it for $500 for 2 years. And then, yeah, so I'm racing one last time on Nikita Francis is my bike's name. And then, as soon as my race at the end of the month is over, I'll start riding the new bike.
And have you given that bike a name?
Her name's Bernadette. Well, it means, so Ultraman Canada, there's going to be some descents. And bike handling, I would say, is my weak point. At Ultraman Florida, at the U-turns, I had to unclip and strider bike myself around the U-turn. It was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. My crew was like, "We would have pretended we didn't know you." Like I literally unclipped and was like, just pushing myself in the U-turn. So the descents and kind of being brave, I think at Canada is going to be what I need to work on. Mm-hmm. So I looked up names about being brave, and Bernadette means like strong bear. And I was like, well, that's funny because Ultraman had gators and Canada has bears. So I thought brave, strong bear, was a pretty cool name for a bike that's going to come to Canada. So
nice. I like the fact that you recognize where your weaknesses are and you're just like jumping right into like tackle those and make sure that they don't remain that way. You're not one of those people who's like, well, I'm really good at running, so I'm going to do my extra run training. You're like, I need to learn everything I can about biking. So that's a great attitude to have.
It's a hard one. It's a scary one, actually. Like, I'm very scared of wind. I don't like being in wind. So Jeremy and I did a 3-week training camp in Kona, and every day it was like wind advisory. Jeremy's like, grab your bike, let's go. Yeah. And we would get in fights and I would yell and cry, and he would leave me to have my pity party because he knows me so well. That's what needed to happen. And I would just suffer through it. We just put me in every uncomfortable situation. I couldn't even grab a water bottle when I started. I couldn't do anything. So it's been hard. It's been out of my comfort zone a lot, for sure.
Well, Caroline, it's been great talking to you today about all these races you've done and your Ultraman experience and your drive to just like take on triathlon as a full lifetime thing. It's an interesting story to hear, and I'm sure the other athletes will be interested to hear it as well. And that when they're listening to the podcast, I appreciate that you give us such an honest look into your life as well. When you talk about your dark places, and hopefully the other athletes out there, maybe some also struggling with the COVID blues, will be able to take a little bit of something out of that too. And I appreciate how well you were able to talk about that. And I really look forward to meeting you when you come to Penticton.
I'm super excited. I'm really excited. I'm going to get there a couple weeks early and try to see as much of the course as I can, and, you know, make friends with the monster. What's his name again?
Ogopogo.
Ogopogo. Nah. I got to get that tattooed on me as like a peace offering or something.
Maybe on the bottom of your foot, so he'll see it as he's coming at you.
In, for Ultraman, I got a sports bra that had an alligator drinking a beer on it, and I raced in it in day one. I was like, okay, we'll be friends. So, yeah.
Well, thanks again. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And now here's another Steve King story.
Hi, everyone. I'm Steve King. And tonight I'm going to talk about a gentleman who's an athlete out of Guelph, Ontario, Canada. He's a medical physics technician. He's a coach with the Discomfort Zone team. He's an incredible cyclist. In 2013, he raced the Hoodoo 500, which is actually a 520 miler in the state of Utah. His partner, Kate, was on his crew then as well. There's good reason for mentioning that, of course, later on. He's been a stage race winner and course record holder at the Cripple Creek Crippler, 207 miles in Colorado, including 30,000 feet of climbing. Did that in 13 hours, 42 minutes in 2013. Did the Furnace Creek 508 and was on a winning two-person team in that event. A good runner too, of course. He did the Around the Bay 30K, has done a 203.14. The longest living road race in Canada. Lots of Kenyans now come and do that event. Has raced Ironman, I think, has done a 9:21 for the distance. 2008 at a PB, the Beach to Battleship race. 50-minute swim, a 501 bike, and a 3:21 on the run. 2015, he did the Ironman Muskoka. Was second overall coming into T2, but ended up going over 4 hours for the marathon, so finished with around 10:52. But he's been building on his running too. He did 50K and 50-mile trail runs as well. Did his first Ultraman here in Penticton when he came to Ultraman Canada and came third overall that year. However, look at who he was behind. Two incredible Australians, one who lives here, Kevin Karchar, who actually won the world title in 1995, and the other being Mike LaRue, who won the world championships in 2010. But that year, this gentleman in 2010 in Canada and that third place did 23:33. The following year, he went to the Big Island to do the world championships, 2011. And he came second to the incredible Brazilian, Alexandre Ribeiro, who ended up winning six world titles at the Ultraman distance. But in 2011 on the Big Island, this gentleman swam a 256 and rode a 450 bike. That was for a 746 on day one. And he was the first man to arrive then. He also was the first on day two with a 744 clocking. However, despite the fact he ran a 647 and ended up with a 22:19 overall clocking. He was just a little bit back, of course, of the gentleman who won, being Ribeiro. So you look at what happened in that. He was second overall, but won his age division, then decided to return to Hawaii in 2015. Remember, he had been third in Canada, second on the Big Island at the World Championships, and returned 4 years later to take that race on again. He had almost a similar time, but it was a personal best by a few seconds in the swim, and it was a personal best by just a few seconds in the bike when he just went inside 450. So he did 746 and was doing really well, of course, leading the way there. And then that second day, he had the most phenomenal bike ride. He did a 710 clocking on that bike, which was a record for day two on the Big Island. He ran just second shy of what he had run before. He did a 6:48 this time, ended up with a 21:44:18 clocking, which at that point was a world best in the men's 40 to 49 division. So out of three races, he was third, he was second, and in 2015, he came away with the overall world title. So our congratulations to this man who I last saw in 2017, when Penticton hosted the ITU World Long Course Championships, and the Canadian Lionel Sanders won the event. This gentleman, I turned around, and there he was on the podium behind me with his baby in arms. And that's why I mentioned his partner, Kate, as well, because they're a family now. And the man I'm referring to, Michael Coghlan.
Hey,
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Kat Viler from Arlington, Massachusetts. I'm the 2019 Ultraman Canada Female Champion. You can hear about how I prepared for the race and strategies I used to get through the 3 days in beautiful Penticton by listening to my conversation with Larry in Season 1, Episode 8. You also won't want to miss the bonus episode where we discuss a number of interesting issues I've worked on in my day job as a law professor. Happy training and racing. Cheers.
Today's featured guest has completed 39 full distance events and competed at Kona 8 times. He has 4 Ultraman distance races and a win at Ultraman Australia. He holds a number of world championships in his age group at various distances. These days, when not traveling, training, or racing, he is rescuing dogs and working with other athletes through his coaching business, 859 Coaching. Joining me from the Netherlands, where he will be racing tomorrow, please welcome Arno Sulikov. Welcome to 515.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So where exactly are you at in the Netherlands right now, and what's the event that you're there for?
So, a small editing because you say 39, this is what I told you, but in between I've been racing a little bit more and the count is at the moment at 41. So tomorrow is going to be my 42nd full distance. Tomorrow I'm racing the ITU long course, the Challenge Almere Amsterdam, which is the support for the ITU long course. And usually it's a race which is done on the old Nice distance, 4 kilometers, 120 and 30. But this year they are doing it on the full distance, the Ironman. So it was not planned, but it was not planned to be that close from Roth last weekend. But COVID has thrown a spanner in the wheel, and we had the race has been moved around. So
right.
These two races finally ended up on the calendar, one in the 5th of September last week, and one tomorrow. So. Almere, which is the oldest European race, full distance European race, because the first race happened here in 1983. So like the first year of the Ultraman.
Yeah.
So tomorrow we are celebrating the 40th anniversary of this race. So it's a big event. It's a funny place because it's in a place that has been reclaimed on the sea. So it's absolutely pancake flat. And we are surrounded by windmills, so can give you an idea of the weather we are going to face. It's pretty windy and dead flat and basically no protection. So, but it's part of the game, and it's, I hope it's going to be a very nice race, and I hope I will have recovered from last week.
Mm-hmm. And how did you do last week in Roth?
Not too bad. I went 8:59 and I was third in my age group. But the bike leg has been shortened a little bit by around 10 kilometers because there was some road construction and they couldn't get around. So I've been sub-9 twice already in Roth. So I was really happy to be in 8:59 again, but it was not the right distance. So I'm not going to claim it.
Yeah. That makes sense. I'm looking back on your history, and it looks like your story of what brought you to triathlon is not totally uncommon in the triathlon world. You come from a bit of a troubled background as a youth. Can you tell us a little bit about that background and what young Arno was like, so that we can kind of get a picture of what you've become as well?
Well, yeah, I hope my son are not going to listen, but I was I was absolutely not into sport, and I was trouble everywhere, and whatever I was doing, it was always trouble. So, partying, and I've always been trying to be very good at what I was doing. So when I was partying and drinking and smoking weed, I was very good at it. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, and especially when I was at the army, I've been for the first time in my life in contact with sport. So the captain of the place where I was doing my army time offered me a pair of shoes, and he was bringing me pretty much every day for running in the woods. So either you were doing the shore at the place where we were living, or you had the possibility to go running. So obviously I pick up running, and this is really where I discover and embrace sport. So was very much like a life-changing experience for me. And I will be forever grateful for that then. And yeah, I think now 32 years later, I can really say it saved my life. So.
Yeah. And was that a gradual thing for you to like leave the partying behind and get to the sport? Or was there a time where it was like one was cut off and the other began?
Well, yeah. When I pick up triathlon, I just wanted to become good at it. But, you know, it was a time where there was no, as I said, there was no internet, there was no training. We don't know what we were doing. And because I left my parents' place when I was 18, I had to make a living also. So I was working full time and I got married. I was very young. I was 21 years old. And I got my twins when I was 25. Mm-hmm. So when you have a family and when you are married and when you have a mortgage, then you need to go working. So at this time was pretty different. And so originally triathlon was more like I was taking it more leisurely. I was more like the weekend thing and meeting some friend and going for a ride outside. But more and more it took a lot of place in my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite competitive. Obviously when you are training with your mate, you always want to be the first at the next village. And then when you are swimming in the lake, you want to be the first of the water. And this is pretty much how it started. But another turn has been taken when a bit later, like 14 years ago, when I was living in Asia, because I had to move to Asia for work. Mm-hmm. And then I took up triathlon much more seriously because I was managing a company there, which was my company. So I had a little bit more time. And being in Asia, it was very easy to travel to some very nice destination like Australia, mm-hmm. New Zealand, and all the place that you cannot basically go when you are in Europe because it's too far and too expensive. Mm-hmm. And the triathlon scene in Asia when I arrived there was growing a bit like, it was a bit like the 90s in Europe. It was 2006 when I arrived in Asia, and it was like 15 years ago in Europe, you know. Triathlon was new, people were picking it, and there was a lot of interest around the triathlon. And it was like a second, a rediscovery of the triathlon and a different kind of way of doing it for me. And I started to race long distance.
You're clearly, from what you've answered already, the type A goal-oriented type of person that goes all in. And I'm sure many listeners are able to identify with you on that level. And in 2010, nearly 20 years after you began your tri career, you set three goals for yourself. And at that time, all of them seemed quite lofty for you, as you said. But you started down the path of getting serious about that training. And I'd just like to speak to each one of those briefly. Your first one was to race in Kona, like so many people. And
yeah.
And we already had the spoiler in the intro saying that you reached that goal at least 8 times over now. But before you did face a little bit of adversity trying to get there while you were headed there. Can you tell us about that adversity where you were a little bit let down on reaching that goal and then how it finally came together for you to reach that goal and get to Kona?
Yeah, I mean, when I decided I wanted to go to Kona, it was because I'm coming from a simple background. My father was a worker in a factory, and Hawaii was out of reach. I mean, it's far, and it was definitely even further than what I could expect. And because of triathlon, Hawaii is a bit of the ground zero of what we are doing, and going there, I think, was a dream, first of all, and was also to try to prove myself that I can make it happen. So something that was out of reach when I was a kid, trying to make it happen. So Of course, there is the financial way of going to Hawaii, but as a triathlete, I wanted to go to Hawaii as a qualified athlete. And to get to Hawaii, you need to qualify. And at the time, the time to qualify were so out of reach. Fixing myself this challenge was a bit like, putting always a carrot in front of me to try to keep me moving. Mm-hmm. And I never actually, some people say I never doubted I was going to make it. Actually, in my case was I never believed I would make it. And there was one race, I was supposed to race Ironman Korea in 2011. And that was the race where I was supposed to qualify, and pretty much easily, because my time in training were good. My coach told me that should happen, and there was a fair bit of slot at this race, and I went there and I missed the last slot by I can't remember, but I think it's something like a minute, and one of my best friends at the time got the slot to get there, and I don't want to say there was jealousy, but it really broke me. I was so disappointed. You know, it's like when everybody is telling you, but this is a bit like the story of life. You know, people is telling you, oh, you will make it. So you end up believing that you are going to make it and you don't need to work that hard. And when I fail, I had to reassess everything. And and I had to sit back and I had to decide what has been working well and what has not been working. And I mean, to this day, I'm not taking any start of any full distance race without thinking of this time of my life when I almost believe it was going to be so easy that I even didn't need to race. I mean, the slot was waiting for me, but then I didn't get it. So then you go back to the drawing board and you work harder. And it was really a click, and I really decided to work harder and to just. I have no talent for sport, but I just wanted to get there because I was working harder than everybody else. If my friend was doing 10 kilometers, I was doing 15. If he was riding 5 hours, I was riding 7 hours. So, and finally it happened. And the day it happened for me, it was like, you know, when you have the birth of your first child, it was something like, it's so big, it's so unbelievable. And I was just like, you know, I'm still getting emotional to this day when I'm thinking of my first qualification and the first time I got handed the slot and the paper and have to pay. And I think I never pay $1,000 so happily in my life. But yeah, it was a big day. And, you know, it's a bit like the performance when you are looking at the history of athletics people. They know they like Roger Bannister when he broke the 4 minute for the mile.
Right.
Nobody was able to make it. And then he broke it. And then everybody went over the barrier. It was like the 8 hours mark on the Ironman. When Lothar Leder broke it, then it opened the door for something for some other people to do it. And for me, it was a bit like that. And and once I've done it, I couldn't stop doing it again.
that addictive personality from your youth came back.
Yeah, I think, and first of all, I love Kona. Yeah, it's a beautiful place. It's a place where I'm feeling good, and it's a place where you still feel it's something special when you get there for the Ironman World Championship. Either you like it or you don't like it, and I'm not sucking that much to the Ironman brand. I just like the place. I like the setup of the race, and the place is just so beautiful. And it's also a race which is keep on walking away from me. I never had a good race in Kona.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's one of the reasons why I still want to go back there, because I had some good performance in my athletic life, but I never had the race I think I could do on this island. So maybe one day it will happen. But if it doesn't happen, I mean, it's okay. I'm in peace with that. But if it can happen, then I will give it a crack.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's always about how you are on the day. Yeah.
And you know, it always arrive late in the season for us Europeans. So,
right.
I never made the choice to say, I'm not racing anything and I'm putting all my money on Kona. And this is not the way I'm working and this is not the way I'm thinking. So Kona is there, I take it. If I'm racing well, it's perfect. If not, I mean, that's it.
Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking about the Roger Bannister 4-minute mile, and once that was broken, you know, it opens the floodgates and things like that. And for you, you had one of those as well, where it was a time goal. You know, your second goal you set for yourself back at that time was to go sub-9. In 2016, I think you were training pretty hard, and you figured you were ready to meet that goal, like. You figured you were ready to get your slot in Korea, but once again, there was a little bit of a problem when you were trying to reach that goal of going sub-9 in Ironman Austria. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was 2014 actually. And my coach at the time was Jürgen Zak. And we made the plan to race Ironman Austria because Jürgen, I never raced there before, and Jürgen was thinking it was suiting my strength quite well with a challenging bike course. And it was pretty much the same story. I was almost sure I was going to go sub-9 there. Everybody was telling me, oh, you've been 9:04 in Roth, so it's going to be a walk in the park. But it didn't happen that way. I had a horrible day and... no legs on the bike, and I hated any minute of this race. And I'm still I never went back there, and I don't think I will ever, I ever will, because there was few things I hated in the race. But it's not much the race I was hating; it was my performance on the day and the way I've been giving up on that at the beginning of the run, because I didn't have the swim I was expecting, and I didn't have the bike I was expecting. I just let it go. So I finished the race, but I was very, it was like a mental DNF, if you want. I just crossed the finish line on that day. And I was really disappointed about my performance and the way I handled the pressure. So basically I did nothing for a couple of weeks. And then Jürgen called me and he said, you want to race Roth with me? And I said, well, let's do it. And I went in Roth like, really like a tourist. I've been racing Roth twice in 2012 and 2013, and the ambience is different. And I always had a good feeling with this race. And it happened that through Jürgen, I met Felix Walschofer, the organizer of Challenge Roth, and he's one of the nicest people you can see. This guy has a massive heart, and he's such a nice guy. And we have always been trying to support his race because the sweeters may be better, you know, like a smaller organization, very centered around the family and the athlete and not so much about the money. So I went to Challenge Roth and I raced without a watch and I finished in 8:59, which for me was just amazing. And I didn't understood right at the beginning I went 8:59 because I registered so late I had to start in one of the last wave and when I crossed the finish line the clock was not showing my time, and it's just when I finished someone told me that I actually went sub-9, and it was just like, you know, it was such a massive goal and a massive pressure out of me that I couldn't stop racing this year. I think I registered for all the races which were around just because I wanted to keep milking the cow and see how far and how fast I can go. But it was a massive achievement for me, and it's something that I've done it a few times after that. But the emotion you get when you manage to do something like that, and I won my age group on that day. It was a very hot day. And I outran Pete Jacob, who was the 2012 Ironman World Champion on that day. I caught him he was not in a good day, obviously, but I still passed him. And for me, it was just like, you know, beginning of the marathon, I was running shoulder to shoulder with Lothar Leder. And then I passed Jürgen Zak, who was racing also on that day. And then I passed Pete Jacob. And it was just like, you know, keep coming. It's just too good to be true. So it was a fantastic day and certainly one of the best days of my life, yes. Mm.
And that race has some really good fan experience as well, where they're lining the course and cheering you on. Do you think that maybe that extra little boost and that I don't care attitude, I'm here as a tourist on this one, was what let you relax enough and enjoy the moment? And then you start picking off these friends of yours and people that you know, and it just all came together for you?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking of this race for a long time, but because you sometimes it's just falling into place. And I think it was the right race coming at the right moment. Obviously, the ambience is rough. It's something completely different. You have people line up all around the course. Mm-hmm. And the running course along the canal, the whole course was treating me very well. Running on small gravel, it's a bit softer on the leg. And I think it was just saving a bit the legs. And the end of the run course, when you go back into Roth, where you have all this table line with people, you know, enjoying mm-hmm. and partying, and the finish line, which is
the finish massive. Line is like stadiums kind of finish line.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's big. The experience is big. The ambience is big, and it's just a lovely place. And you know, Roth is a very small city. I think I don't want to say some stupid number, but I think it's just less than 10,000 people living there, mm-hmm. and. They have this massive event coming every year in front of their doorstep. And some people there were telling me that basically imagine you have the Tour de France coming in front of your doorstep every year and just turning in front of you for 12 hours.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, Bavaria, Roth is quite remote. I mean, Nuremberg is like 35 kilometers, but the big German city are quite away from that. And you have this massive afflux of people coming to watch the race. It's just something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had the opportunity to go when my ex-wife was racing there, and yeah, it was one of the better races that we went to as far as ambiance for sure. Well, let's move on to that third goal that you had, and it follows pattern. In that your third goal, your final goal was to win a world championship title. And when you first seriously targeted this, what distance were you looking at to reach this goal? And what race were you looking at? Because as I said, it kind of followed pattern for your goal.
Yeah.
So what was the first time you thought you were going to get it?
And there is a distance that I really love. It's the old Nice distance, which was 420 and 30. And that's the distance that ITU has decided to choose for the long course, except this year. And it's something that I think I could do well at, because I'm always tending to fade a little bit at the end of a marathon. And I was thinking maybe 30 kilometers is going to be a different story. And so I raced for the first time the ITU Long Course World Champ in Denmark in Finn. It was 2018, I think. And each federation in the world have a certain quantity of slot they can allocate to their athlete. So you don't have a cup qualification per se, but you are chosen by your federation. And because I was racing for so long in Asia, at the French Federation, I didn't even own a French license anymore, and nobody knew me. So I had to come back with, I had to do some race in Europe, and especially Roth was playing a big role on that. And because I went 8:59, and then I went 8:56, and I won my age group, and I went 9:02 in Vichy in France, when I was still living in Asia. I got noticed, and I managed to get chosen by the French Federation to race there in Finn. And I was in the 45 to 49, and there was an American guy who was an amazing runner. And he's still an amazing runner, but he's a bit younger than me. And I lead off the swim, and then I was leading off the bike, and he caught me with, I think, 6 kilometers to go. And if I'm correct, he ran 1:52 on that day for the 30 kilometers. So we managed to run shoulder to shoulder for like 3-4 kilometers, and then he dropped me like a bad habit. And I was really disappointed, because, you know, when for 20 kilometers you are running and you are, I mean, virtually world champion, And I knew this guy was coming back because very often the ITU, they choose a multiple lap course. Like, for example, tomorrow it's a six lap of 7 kilometers. And sometimes you have out and back so you can see where the other guy are. Mm-hmm. And when he passed me and then he went in front and then he took 1 meters and 2 meters. And it was like, if you know, when you take the toys off the kid and I finished second and everybody was super happy for me and congratulate me for that. And but I was so bloody disappointed. I could have punched me. I would have done that because there was nothing I can do. The guy was a better athlete, but I was so disappointed. Basically, didn't do much for the few weeks, and then the fire get back again, and I set my sight on this course again for next year, which was held in Pontevedra in Spain, just north of the Portugal border. Mm. And I went there certainly with the best preparation I ever had in my life. I was second off the water and I bike in front, and then I had a good run. And I can say I really loved this race in the way that I knew I was in the lead. I knew I was strong on the run and I knew that no one was going to catch me on the run. And it was so fantastic. But when I crossed the finish line, they forget to call me as the world champion. So when I was in the rest area, I didn't know that. So I had to wait to get my bag. And my wife, she was calling me and she was screaming at me, "Oh, you made it, you made it." And it was, you know, it was amazing. I mean, the feeling was amazing. Mm-hmm. And because for a kid like me, I remember when I was a kid, I was doing nothing at school. I was doing nothing at sport in school. Everything was a pain for me. And I remember one of my sport teacher, he wrote on my school booklet that I certainly didn't have reached my top level. So I would love to see him again today and to show him that actually I was not so bad. And it's a story I like to tell because so many kids sometimes, you know, today, especially in our world, the kids that just want the thing to happen like that fast.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they go on Instagram and in Facebook and it's full of, you know, beautiful story. But this is not like that, you know. And you have to put the work and you have to put the will, because if you don't do that, I mean, this is not happening.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that you prove is then you also have to be willing to take the disappointments in order to get to that level of success. You have to be willing to come second. You have to be, and some children today, if they're not going to be first, they don't want to do anything. And they can't get the first because they don't want to put the work in. So it ends up being this, you know, cycle of not doing anything. How do you think it's affected your own children? You have three children. Have they seen what you've done? Do they pick up on the hardworking habits? Tell me a little bit about how it's affected your own family.
So I have two twins who are 26 today. So they've known me from my they are from my previous marriage. So they know me from my previous life, where I was a director of a company and working well. I was the mayor of my village. I was elected in the region. And so I was trying to juggle, you know, 1,000 things around. And then I had another life when I divorced and I moved to Asia and I had another kid. And my little one, Mika, which is not so little anymore because he's 12, he has only seen me racing and training at my best. Mm-hmm. For Mika, the only holidays we were taking and the only holiday we are still taking is to get to Kona, to get to a race. Last weekend, I hope the director of his school is not going to listen to the podcast because he missed the beginning of the school year because I took him with me in Roth because he just wanted to be there, you know. And last time we were in Kona, when I was going for a swim, it was Craig Alexander who was keeping an eye on him when he was on the beach. So
it's a good babysitter.
Yeah, he's doing a good job. But, you know, for Mika, holiday and life is triathlon. And he starts racing at the moment and he's quite talented and he's doing athletics. So he's a very good runner, but definitely my life, I mean, as a triathlete, has definitely impacted him a lot and is certainly going to impact him a lot. My two older kids, they are today at the moment they are living in Norway, and they are running a restaurant there. So they've started their own restaurant like 6 months ago. So when you own a restaurant,
that's a great time to start a restaurant during the middle of the pandemic, where they get closed down regularly.
Yeah, yeah. But actually, it was funny because when we decided, when we talked with them, it was their decision. So you know, kids, you can tell them what to do, but some, you know, they never listen. But actually, I told them, I say, maybe, you know, it's like when a forest has burned. There is always something growing up after. So this pandemic maybe is an opportunity. So try to make it. Maybe you will go as a slow start. Maybe you don't need to have many staff at the beginning. Maybe you can just start with a couple of tables and see how it's going. And turn out they did a very good job as starting their restaurant, and they are very successful. And today they are based in Bergen. And today if you go to have dinner on a weekend in their restaurant, it's like 2-3 months of waiting. So they are doing sport, but more like as a pressure valve, you know, because Jules is a chef, so he's like 14 hours a day in the kitchen, and Nicolas is the maître d'hôtel, and he's receiving the clients, so he's always in contact. So they do sport. They are incredibly talented because Jules is running basically like 5 kilometers a week, and he can run 4 minute pace, but they don't have. They don't have this attraction for long distance and for triathlon. Maybe it will come. I don't know. And to be honest, I would love to do a triathlon relay one day with them, or to stand on the starting line with any of them. But if it doesn't happen, it's okay. And as long as they are happy in what they are doing. And, you know, I know when I was their age, I was trying to steer clear of what my father was doing. So... it is what it is.
So, yeah, and I think probably whether they're involved in sport or not, though, still learning from what they've seen from you do your sport, the perseverance, the goal setting, the working hard to get to it is going to help them run a restaurant or whatever it is they want to do.
Oh, yeah, I think so, because, you know, nothing is easy in life. And when you want to achieve something, you have to put the work down. And if you don't do the work, that then it's not going to happen. You know, success, there is only in the dictionary that success is before working. So it's, yeah. And, you know, I'm also, when I'm setting up a goal, I'm like a train. I'm on the rail and nothing can distract me. So that's a way of life. And I'm a simple guy. I'm living a very simple life. So, and the older I'm growing, I try not to be distracted by shit around. I don't watch TV. I don't buy the newspaper, and I'm not listening to radio, because we always hear the same thing, and this is just like, you know, noise coming your way. And what I've discovered is the simple I'm making my life, the happier I am. Mm. So this is, if there is one thing I want them to learn from, that is make your life simple, you know, have a passion and let it kill you, you know, at some point. It's a, whatever it is, but when you have a passion, life is much more exciting.
Yeah. Hmm. You know, this is the 5:15 podcast, so we should probably speak a little bit about your Ultraman experience as well. So you found along the way that you enjoyed going longer, and then obviously, like most people do, you figure, well, what's longer than what I'm doing? And you discover that there's an Ultraman distance race out there. What were you doing at the time, and how did you find out about it? Who brought you to Ultraman, or what brought you to Ultraman?
That's a funny story, because it was a time where I was still drinking, and it was after Busselton, and still drinking. I mean, I was not alcoholic, but I was, you know, having few beer with mate and going out for party. And we were in Singapore with some of my friends, and one of them was Pete Short, and he's an Australian and a very, very good friend of mine. And we all raced Busselton, and we had a celebration party at a restaurant. And then we went for some more drinks, and we were pretty drunk at the time, and Pete sort of took out his iPad and he said, I'm just going to register for an Ultraman right now. And I was just, what are you doing? And what is an Ultraman? And then we started talking, and then we were four and three of them register. And this is how I would say maybe the seed was planted. I was thinking, oh, it's interesting. And then the next day, when the hangover was gone, they tried to push back their registration for the following year because they thought that maybe they've done something stupid. But I was keep thinking of that. And it was the first year of Ultraman Australia. I think it was 2015. And 2016, I decided to race Ultraman Australia. And I went there with no expectation. My coach at the time was Cameron Brown. And we tried to change a little bit the way I was running. And I think I was running pretty well at the moment. And but it's hard because when you are new to Ultraman, the distance are so big. And how are you going to adapt your training to that? So the decision was pretty simple, was to try to train like for an Ironman and just had some very long training session in the middle. Mm-hmm. And it worked pretty well because I won the race. And it was a magical experience for me. And I think on my tombstone, I want to have my name and the winner of Ultraman Australia 2016. That's all I want. The experience was amazing. And you know, I mean, it's a small field. I think I'm not big at writing, but I wrote a race report after the race. And I say I discovered a side of my sport where the grass is greener. And it was very much my thought because I done just four Ultraman, but I've made more friends in the four Ultraman than in my 41 Ironman. Mm-hmm. And I raced Ultraman Australia. And then the year after I raced Ultraman Hawaii, where I got a demonstration by Rob Gray of what is a great performance. And then the year after I raced Ultra 515 in Canada. And I got my ass kicked also by David Matheson, mm-hmm. and amazing athlete and a good friend also. And then in 2019, I went back to Ultraman Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And so I always race well there, and I love the format, I love the race, I love the people, and you know, you get the feeling that when you go to this race, you always meet the same people, and if it means going to Hawaii to meet your friend, then so be it, and just have a good run on the Queen Key and see what happens. But yeah, I think one of the strongest friendship I've made in this sport was with the people I met at Ultraman.
Yeah, and that's what Ultraman's all about, is the Ohana and the connections that you make. And I think that's why
people, absolutely,
once they're in, they never leave. It's like a mafia.
yeah. You know, and it's like the girl doing the massage at Ultraman Australia, she actually ended up crewing for me at Ultraman Hawaii, Gail Lowe, that certainly you know. And she went and she came with one of her friends, and you know, there is always support, and I always tell the story. But when I raced the first time in Ultraman in Hawaii, I raced the Ironman a few weeks before. And when I was in the transition in the morning, I asked the guy beside me if he can give me his pump to pump my tire, and he said no. And I was just like, "Holy shit, what a dick!" And and then when I raced Ultraman, on day two, I was leading the race and I was making time on Rob Gray, and I lost my my crew. And it's actually the crew of Rob Gray who came to me and asked me if I needed food or drink or anything, mm-hmm. despite the fact that I was gaining time on him.
Yeah.
And
that's the Ultraman way.
Exactly. That's the whole idea of the thing. And it's treating me so much better. And I'm a bit sad that the past 2 years we haven't been able to race there. Mm-hmm. But the race will happen again, I think, maybe next year, and hopefully we can meet again. All these small, you know, it's just 40, 50 people, but there is something, there is a connection, and And for me, every time I'm coming home after racing an Ultraman, it's like if the human race is feeling, you know, you have a better feeling for it. The people are nicer, and you know, it's just something. It's a special thing. Very special for me.
Yeah, for sure. Certainly is. Just before we go, I do have one more thing to ask you about. Like I mentioned in the intro that you also have taken on coaching roles now and you have your coaching to do. Are there any athletes that you coach that you would like to do a shout out for? Maybe someone who needs a little encouragement with a race coming up, or someone who deserves some props for a race they've done or some breakthroughs?
Last week, actually in Roth, one of my long-term athletes has a real breakthrough, because it was only his third full distance. And the first time is someone which is very well overwhelmed by his nerve. And it's very hard for him to control when the race day is coming. So the first time I took him with me in Busselton, I asked him to register. I think it was 10 days ago. So he didn't have to think about that. And he went 11:01. And then he came back the year after and he went 10:01. And last weekend in Roth, he went 9:17. So Matt definitely deserved the big shootout, and but all my guy, I have a guy in Australia and which I'm coaching for a long time, and I know he's struggling a lot at the moment with all the successive lockdown and 5 kilometers radius, and Australia is a real pain in the ass in terms of lockdown at the moment, and especially from one state to another one, and all the race has been cancelled, and Bundy is a very, very good guy. And I really would like him to keep it up. And I know we all have challenging time at sometimes, but he will just get stronger out of that. And but all my guys, I have 19 guys at the moment. Oh. And one of the girls, she raced today in Holland for a running race. And today I have two guys who qualify for the 70.3 world champ at 70.3 Luxembourg. Tomorrow, I have a very good friend of mine and one of my athletes, which is racing in Nice. Last week in Roth, I met again with Chloe Lane, who was the winner of Ultraman Australia in 2016 when I won. And I did not know she was there. She did not know I was there. And we passed each other on the run. And she said, "Hey, Arnaud," and I just wanted to stop and hug her. But there was no mean to do so. But we did it after. And she's racing tomorrow in 70.3 Nice. But this is, again, you know, an Ultraman story. It's we just sat at the prize ceremony last week and we were just talking our story about Ultraman and how our life has been changing in between, and how this race has really, you know, sometimes... life is never from point A to point B. It's never a straight line. There is always some change of direction. Ultimately, we always made it, but it's full of nice story and again a great friendship. And I wish her all the best tomorrow in this year.
Awesome, that's awesome. Yeah, it's the Ohana just pop up all over the place. Well, yeah. I would like to thank you for taking the time out of your race prep to have this conversation today. Good luck with your race tomorrow. And hopefully we're crossing paths soon at one of these races.
Thank you for having me on the show. And I think it's good to have something talking about Ultraman and all the ultra distance. And once again, thank you very much and hope to see you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, if you liked what you heard today, please tell a friend and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd rate and review the show while you're there. Drop the names of the people you think we should interview and we'll get in touch with them and make that happen. Thank you for listening to 515, the Ultraman Podcast, a production of 55 Enterprises. Now really, go subscribe now before you forget.